So, before we jump completely into today's material, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 99 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and, unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. It's actually super helpful. So check it out at certfuel.com.
Yeah, it's a really great resource.
It really is.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's set the stakes here. Imagine a client trying to wire, I don't know, like $5 million to close on a commercial real estate deal, right? And the deadline is 4 p.m.
Oh man, the stress.
Right. But because a single authorization signature is missing, or maybe a routing number is off by just one digit, that money just gets trapped.
Yeah, trapped in a brokerage clearing account
Ooh,
indefinitely.
indefinitely. And the financial system, it doesn't run on intent. It doesn't care what you meant to
No,
do.
not at all.
It runs on flawless, ironclad authorization. So welcome to the deep dive on cashiering and account transfers. We are covering the absolute main event for the Series 99 exam today.
It really is the main event.
Yeah, Function 1 represents 35 scored items. That is 70% of your entire exam.
70%, which is just massive. I mean, it is the foundation of the whole license. If you do not intimately understand how the money and the assets actually, physically move through the financial plumbing, none of the other regulations even matter
Right.
because cashiering is the physical reality of the financial market.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because cashiering is essentially the firm's controlled handoff point. You can think of it like the central nervous system of a brokerage. Every single movement of a dollar or a share needs the exact right instruction, the exact right routing, and a completely unassailable paper trail.
Precisely. And that is exactly why this material is so heavily tested. The operations personnel, they're really the unsung heroes here
Oh, for sure.
because they're the ones turning abstract, sometimes very chaotic customer instructions into legally binding, fully documented movements of real assets. I mean, they build and maintain the actual rails that the whole financial system runs on.
Absolutely. And so listen up. If you zone out during this deep dive, you are leaving 70% of your exam on the table. If you have ADHD like me and you learn better through ridiculous stories than dry textbooks, stay with us. We are going to lock this in together using some very specific characters and scenarios.
Yeah, we've got to make it stick. And the best way to tackle a topic this massive and, this heavily weighted is to build it from the ground up.
Right.
Before we can talk about moving a customer's entire life savings to a new firm, we have to understand the mechanics of how individual dollars and individual shares move on a regular day-to-day basis.
The daily plumbing. And that brings us to the first major conceptual divide. We need to look at internal versus external movements. Well, let's do a direct comparison here. Wire transfers and ACH versus journals.
Okay, this is a fundamental operational distinction. You must have the actual mechanics memorized, not just the basic definition.
Right, the how and the why.
Exactly. So wire transfers and automated clearinghouse transfers, that's ACH, those use external payment networks. Right. For a wire, you are utilizing systems like Fedwire or CHPS. You are physically moving funds out of your firm's bank account, pushing it across the Federal Reserve's network, and depositing it into a completely different financial institution. It is irrevocable and it is immediate.
Boom, it's gone.
Exactly. Now, ACH is also external, but it uses batch processing through the clearinghouse, so it takes a day or two to fully settle.
So with wires and ACH, the money is actually leaving the building. It goes out into the wild.
Yes. A journal, on the other hand, is an internal book entry route. It is only moving cash or securities between accounts at the exact same firm.
Yep.
It never leaves the broker-dealer's ecosystem at all. It is simply a debit to one ledger and a credit to another ledger on the same internal computer system.
All right, pause right here. Let's bring in our first recurring character to really visualize this. We will call him Panicked Pete.
Panicked Pete, I like it.
Yeah, Panicked Pete is highly reactive, constantly checking his portfolio on his phone, always making really hasty financial decisions.
We all know a panicked Pete.
We do. So let's say Pete wants to move $5,000 in cash from his individual account to his wife's account, which happens to be held at the exact same brokerage firm. So if Pete pushes that transfer button on his app, what network does the firm use? Wire, ACH, or journal? I'll give you a second.
Think about where the money is going.
Right. If you said journal, you nailed it. Because his wife's account is at the same firm, the money never actually has to hit the Federal Reserve System. It just moves from one line on the firm's ledger to another. It never leaves the firm's books.
Spot on, but this is where the exam tries to get you. Test writers absolutely love to exploit the confusion between the customer's view and the firm's operational reality.
Oh, because of the monthly statements.
Exactly. A retail customer like Panicked Pete is going to look at his monthly statement and see wires, ACH deposits, and journals all listed together under a generic column called activity or transfers.
Right. It just looks like money moving.
Right. So the exam will try to trick you into classifying a journal as an external movement because it shows up on the statement alongside external wires. Do not fall for it. A journal is strictly an internal accounting entry.
That is such a good trap to look out for. So we know the routing mechanisms, but Panicked Pete can't just, you know, yell at his phone and make the money jump from his account to his wife's. There has to be an authorization mechanism.
Right. It's not magic.
Exactly. So what are the tools we use to authorize these movements? Because I constantly see LOA and medallion signature guarantee thrown around interchangeably in study groups, and they are definitely not the same thing.
They absolutely are not. And confusing them will definitely cost you points on test day. An LOA is a letter of authorization. This is just a written instruction from the customer authorizing a very specified, designated movement of funds or securities.
Okay, so it's Beat saying, in writing, move exactly $5,000 from account A to account B on this specific date.
Right. The LOA is the instruction. It is the what. But the medallion signature guarantee, that is the how do we know it is really Pete.
Hey, let's go deep on how a medallion actually works.
Yeah.
Because I think people just assume it's like getting something notarized at the post office. It's not just a notary stamp.
No, that is a critical distinction. A notary just verifies identity, basically saying, yes, this person showed me their driver's license. A medallion signature guarantee is a highly regulated financial liability shield specifically designed for securities transfers.
A liability shield?
Yes. When a financial institution affixes a medallion stamp to a transfer document, they are financially backing that signature. If it turns out Panicked Pete's identity was stolen and the signature is a forgery, the institution that stamped it absorbs the financial loss.
Oh, wow.
They are literally guaranteeing the signature with a surety bond.
That is wild. So the stamp itself has actual financial weight.
Right.
If I'm the brokerage firm that is being asked to transfer the stock out, and I see a valid medallion stamp on the paperwork, I'm off the hook. The bank that stamped it takes all the risk.
Exactly. That is exactly why it is required for physical securities transfers or complex account changes. It protects the transfer agent and the carrying firm from fraud liability.
Okay, that makes so much sense. So we have specific instructed movements down. Now let's talk about the passive movement of cash. Because Panicked Pete sells some stock, and now he has cash just parked in his account. The exam requires you to know the difference between reinvestment and sweeps.
Yes, and they handle parked cash in very different ways.
Right. Well, reinvestment feels pretty intuitive to me. It means putting the money right back to work in the same asset. Like the dividend distributions or the proceeds from a mutual fund sale are automatically used to acquire fractional additional shares of that exact same investment. So the cash never really sits there. It just buys more of what generated it.
Yes. Reinvestment is compounding the specific asset. It's a closed loop. But a sweep is an automated cash management tool. A sweep automatically transfers a customer's free credit balances, which is just their uninvested cash sitting in the brokerage account, into a yield-bearing vehicle.
And what kind of vehicle?
Typically a money market mutual fund or sometimes an FDIC-insured bank account.
Okay, so it's basically an automated parking garage for your cash.
I like that analogy.
Yeah, the valet just takes the uninvested cash at the end of the day and parks it in this other lot where it can earn a little bit of interest instead of just sitting in the main account earning absolutely nothing.
That is the core function, yes. But let's look at the operational mechanics, because what's fascinating here is how a sweep works on the way out. This is a common operational pitfall for test takers.
Okay, lay it on me.
The sweep-in is automatic. At the end of the trading day, the firm system sweeps the excess cash into the money market fund without anyone pushing a button. But to get those proceeds back out, say Pete wants to actually withdraw the cash to his checking account, or he wants to use it to buy a new stock, the customer must explicitly order liquidation of those money market fund shares.
Wait, hold on. That feels completely asymmetric.
Mm-hmm.
If the firm is legally allowed to sweep my cash in every single night without asking me, why am I required to issue a formal liquidation order to get it back out?
Mm-hmm.
Is that like some kind of liquidity protection mechanism for the money market fund?
That is an excellent deduction, and that is exactly why the rule exists. You have to remember, a money market fund is a security. It is a mutual fund.
Oh.
While it is highly liquid, it is not a pure cash bank account. To manage the fund's liquidity and maintain a stable net asset value, the fund managers need clear, documented instructions on redemptions.
Okay, that makes sense.
So while the broker-dealer sets up the automated purchase agreement for the sweep-in, the actual sale of those fund shares requires the customer's directive. Now, usually this is facilitated seamlessly on the back end by the trading platform. When you go to buy stock, you don't necessarily feel it.
Right, the app just handles it.
Exactly. But for exam purposes, the rule is strict. Sweep in is automatic. Sweep out requires a liquidation order.
Sweep in automatic, sweep out requires an order. Got it. Okay, so we've handled the digital routing, we know the liability of the medallion stamp, and we understand the asymmetry of sweep accounts. But what happens when we go old school?
Old school.
Yeah, what happens when the digital networks aren't involved at all, and we have to rely on the physical paper trail? Because physical checks have intensely strict definitions and regulations on this exam.
Oh, they certainly do. Because a physical piece of paper representing thousands of dollars introduces massive operational risk. Check handling combines basic uniform commercial code terminology with incredibly strict broker-dealer controls. If a firm handles a physical check, they need to know exactly who directed the payment, who is physically paying it, who is receiving it, and they need to trace its path flawlessly.
Okay, let's introduce a new character to map out these UCC terms, because they can get confusing.
Let's hear it.
Let's call him Desperate Dan. Dan is highly overleveraged, he's a little shady, and he is writing a physical check to pay for some landscaping work done by our third character, Patient Penny.
Patient Penny?
Yes, Patient Penny. She does great work, she has absolutely no idea about Dan's messy finances. She just wants to get paid for planting his hedges.
A classic transaction. So in this scenario, we have three parties to this negotiable instrument, the check. We have the drawer, the drawdee, and the payee.
Okay, let's walk through this mechanism step by step. Mm-hmm. Dan grabs his pen, and he physically writes the check. He signs his name on the bottom right corner. So Dan is the drawer. He hands the check to Penny. Now, I feel like the natural instinct here is to think Penny is the drawee because she's receiving the physical piece of paper. But she's actually the payee, right? Because she's the one who gets paid.
Correct.
So pause right here. Okay, Dan writes the check. Penny receives the check. Who is the drawee? I'll give you a beat.
Think about who is actually holding the cash.
Right. It's the bank. The drawee is the entity actually being commanded to surrender the cash.
Perfectly reasoned. But this is where the exam tries to get you again. Test writers constantly try to trip candidates up on drawer versus draw. They just sound too similar. But focus on the action. The drawer draws the check. They write the command. That's Desperate Dan.
Right.
The draw is the paying bank that holds the funds and is being directed to pay out. And the payee, Patient Penny, receives the funds.
Dan draws. The bank is the drawee. Penny is the payee. Okay. Now, what happens when a brokerage firm itself is issuing checks out to customers? Why do operations departments care so much about tracking every single piece of paper?
It comes down to a core operational mandate called controlled check issuance. Every single check a firm issues has to be authorized, it has to be sequential, and it must be traceable. A broker-dealer cannot just have a drawer full of blank checks in the break room that any rogue employee can grab.
Obviously not.
To maintain this strict control, the firm uses a ledger called a check blotter.
A blotter. You know, whenever I hear that word, I always think of an old-school police detective's desk, like an ink blotter.
It is essentially an operational detective tool, yeah. But a better analogy might be a restaurant ticket rail in a busy kitchen.
Oh, I like that. So if the kitchen makes a meal, or in our case, the firm clears a check without a corresponding ticket sitting on the rail, the restaurant loses money. Every single dollar leaving the firm must match an authorized stamp ticket on the rail.
Exactly. The check blotter is that ticket rail. It is a highly detailed chronological record of every single issued check. And here is where the exam will test your understanding. What does the blotter actually do?
What's its function?
Right. It supports two vital control functions, tracking and reconciliation. Tracking means we know the sequential number, the exact amount, and the payee. We know exactly where that check went. Reconciliation is the back-end process where the firm matches the checks they issued against the checks that actually cleared the dry bank.
And the exam trap here is that people think a blotter is just a waiting room, right?
Yeah.
Just a list of checks sitting around waiting to be cashed.
Right. It is absolutely not a pending file. It is a permanent historical record of issued checks used to aggressively reconcile the firm's assets against their bank statements. If a check clears the bank but it isn't listed on the blotter, you have a massive unauthorized transfer problem.
A huge problem. All right, let's talk about the dark side of checks. Let's go back to Desperate Dan, who is, as we know, highly overleveraged and desperate for cash. Let's talk about check kiting. What is the actual mechanism of kiting?
Check kiting is a specific type of fraud. It is the fraudulent use of the float, which is the timing differences between financial institutions clearing a check to create the appearance of available funds in an account when no real money actually exists.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I've heard this described like Wile E. Coyote chasing the roadrunner off a cliff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He runs straight off the edge of the cliff. His legs are spinning fast in midair, and he hasn't fallen yet because gravity hasn't realized he's off the cliff.
Yeah.
He is suspended by literally nothing.
That's a great visual.
That midair suspension is the float. So Dan writes a check from his completely empty account at Bank A and deposits it into Bank B. Bank B provisionally credits his account before they actually go and collect the money from Bank A. So for a day or two, Dan has quote-unquote money in Bank B that he can spend, even though Bank A is completely empty. He's floating in midair.
That is the exact mechanism. He is spending provisional credit. But we need to update that coyote analogy for the modern era, because the exam tests the reality of today's operational systems. With the implementation of Check 21, which allows for the digital clearing and electronic image exchange of checks, the industry has practically eliminated the float.
So gravity hits Wile E. Coyote almost instantly now.
Exactly. The digital clearing means Bank B asks Bank A for the money in a matter of hours, not days. But the core principle remains highly testable on the Series 99. Kiting creates apparent funds, not actual funds.
Apparent funds.
Yes. The money is an accounting illusion, and broker-dealers now have automated systems constantly monitoring deposit and withdrawal velocities to catch anyone trying to kite.
So aside from kiting, what other physical check practices are strictly prohibited by the rules?
Well, altering checks is a major violation. You cannot change the payee, you can't change the amount or the date on a check after it has been issued without proper documented authorization from the drawer. That's forgery.
Right.
But a more subtle operational violation that trips up a lot of candidates is the concept of extended check holds.
Explain that, because if I'm an operations clerk and my desk is just completely buried in paperwork, putting a check on hold sounds pretty innocent. Like, oh, I'll just process it on Friday when I have more time.
And that is exactly why it is a heavily tested rule violation. An extended check hold is retaining a customer check without processing it into their account or forwarding it to the clearing department. The regulatory stance is very clear on this. An extended hold is not a neutral delay. It is actively depriving the customer of their capital.
So if Patient Penny gives her brokerage firm a check to deposit, the firm cannot just leave it in a desk drawer for a week because they are short-staffed or, you know, having system issues.
Correct. The rule explicitly states that members must expedite and coordinate authorized asset transfers. Firms cannot retain a customer check without processing it. A hold is not neutral. Both members must expedite things. Failing to process a check promptly is a severe operational failure. You must move the customer's money without delay. No dragging your feet.
Okay, so we know how to move cash internally and externally. We know the liability behind a medallion stamp.
Yeah.
We know how to track physical checks on the blotter. And we know that putting Penny's check in a desk drawer is a strict rule violation. Now, let's escalate the complexity here.
Let's do it.
Let's say Panic Pete is totally fed up with his current broker. He doesn't just want to move some cash around. He wants out completely. He wants to move his entire account, his stocks, his margin balances, his cash, everything to a brand new firm. How do we handle the big move?
This is where we enter the highly regulated world of customer account transfers. And the very first distinction you have to make on the exam is whether the transfer is automated or manual. In industry terms, that means ATATs versus non-ACATs.
ACATs, the Automated Customer Account Transfer Service. It's basically the central nervous system for moving whole accounts or specifically designated assets between brokerages through a centralized automated pipeline.
Yes. ACATS is the high-speed automated highway. But the exam focuses heavily on the initiation process. Where do the instructions actually go to start the process?
Right. So Pete wants to move everything from his old firm, which we will call Shady Securities, to his new firm, which is Shiny and Reputable. Does Pete call Shady Securities and say, hey, I'm leaving, send my stuff? Or does he call the new place to come pull it?
Let's do a direct comparison here because this is heavily tested and you need to lock it in. For an ASATS transfer, meaning a whole account or designated assets moving through that automated system, the customer gives their authorized instructions to the receiving member.
The new firm.
The receiving member. Okay, that makes sense. Pete goes to the new firm. He signs the transfer paperwork there. And the new firm's operations department initiates the ASATS pull. They basically reach into Shady Securities through the automated system and say, give us Pete's stuff.
But what if the plumbing breaks? What if it's a non-ACATS manual transfer?
If it is a non-ACATS transfer, for example, a partial transfer of specific shares that has to be processed outside of the automated system, the authorized alternate instructions go directly to the carrying member, that is the old firm, Shady Securities, that currently holds the assets.
Okay, let me repeat that to lock that mechanism in. An automated ACATS pull is initiated by instructions to the receiving member. A non-ACATS manual push requires instructions sent to the carrying member.
Exactly. And remember this operational reality. ACATS does not cover every single account transfer in the industry. You will see questions trying to trick you into assuming all transfers are ACATS.
Oh, that's tricky.
Yeah. Many partial transfers or transfers involving non-standard assets must be processed manually outside of ACATS using those alternate instructions to the carrying member. Got it. So let's stick with the automated route for a second. Pete goes to the new firm. He submits his ACATS request. The new firm pings Shady Securities through the automated pipeline. Shady Securities gets the notification. What happens the exact second that transfer request is validated by the carrying firm?
The carrying firm, Shady Securities, must instantly freeze the account.
Let's deep dive into what freeze actually entails operationally. Do they just log him out of his app?
It is a complete operational lockdown to ensure the account valuation isn't a moving target during the transfer window. They must immediately cancel all open orders. If Pete had a limit order out there to buy 100 shares of Apple, it's canceled. They can accept no new orders. The account is completely frozen in time.
Wow.
Furthermore, upon validation, Shady Securities must attach all securities positions, safekeeping positions, and money balances exactly as they are currently shown on their books and records.
Wait, exactly as shown on their books? What if Shady Securities says, well, Pete, we show you have $10,000 in cash, but we are currently in a massive dispute with you over a $500 margin interest fee that you refuse to pay, so we're only going to validate $9,500.
This is where the exam tries to get you. That intuition will tell you a firm can protect its fees, but the rule is entirely the opposite. This is a massive trap.
Okay.
The carrying firm cannot take exception to a transfer just because they are having a dispute with the customer over positions or money balances. Holding the account hostage over a math disagreement is a strict rule violation. They must transfer what their books currently show exactly as they are reconciled that day, period.
Wow. They absolutely cannot use the transfer mechanism as leverage to win an argument. Like, we won't let you leave until you admit we're right about this fee. The regulators say no, the transfer process must proceed completely independently of the dispute.
Absolutely. Yeah. The assets must move to protect the customer. The fee dispute can go to arbitration later, but the transfer happens right now. And importantly, this strictness works both ways. The receiving member, the new firm, cannot cherry pick what they want to accept from the ACS feed.
Meaning they can't say, well, we'll gladly take Pete's blue chip stocks and his cash, but we really don't want these highly illiquid, risky penny stocks he owns, so we're rejecting those specific line items.
Correct. If the receiving firm is going to reject the transfer after validation, that rejection applies to the entire account. It is an all or nothing validation process. You can't pick and choose.
Okay, so we've established that ASATS smoothly ports over standard equities, and you can't cherry pick or hold things hostage. But what happens when the automated system hits a brick wall? What happens when the receiving firm software literally doesn't recognize an asset? Let's say Panic Pete bought some obscure proprietary mutual fund that Shady Securities created in-house, and the new firm doesn't have a selling agreement to hold it. How do we handle assets that break the ACCS plumbing?
We classify those as non-transferable assets. And the rules dictate a very specific procedure to resolve the bottleneck. For a whole account transfer containing a non-transferable proprietary product, the old carrying firm has an affirmative duty.
Okay, what do they have to do?
They must provide the customer with a written list of these specific non-transferable assets, and they must make a written request to the customer asking for further instructions on how to dispose of them.
So Shady Securities has to actually send Pete a letter saying, hey, we transferred your Apple stock, but we physically can't move the Shady Securities Gold Fund. Do you want us to liquidate it and send you the cash, or do you want to leave it here in a separate account? And Pete has to reply in writing.
Exactly. It requires written direction from the customer to resolve the non-transferable asset.
That makes sense.
Now let's talk about timing delays, because financial markets do not stop just because an account is frozen for a few days.
Oh, right. Stuff is still happening in the background. Let's run a timeline scenario. Pete's account successfully transfers via ACATS on a Tuesday. The account at Shady Securities is now completely empty and officially closed. But on Thursday, a $500 dividend payment from a stock Pete owned prior to the transfer hits the old closed account at Shady Securities. What is that money called, and what is the operational mechanism for handling it? Pause and deduce this.
Think about the timing.
It arrived after the transfer cleared. It's a residual credit.
Yes. Specifically, an ex-clearing residual credit. Residual credits are cash dividends, interest payments, or even late settling securities that accrue to the account after the primary account transfer has been completed.
So what does Shady Securities do with the 500 bucks? They can't just keep it as an administrative fee for their trouble, right?
Right, definitely not. The operational rule is mandated. Each member must transfer an ex-clearing credit balance after it accrues. You don't have to initiate a whole new manual transfer, though. The automated ACATS facility handles this residual processing to seamlessly sweep those late arriving funds over to the new firm. The plumbing catches the drips.
The plumbing catches the drips. I love that. All right, so we just established that the carrying firm cannot stop a transfer over a money dispute, and the plumbing handles the leftover dividends automatically.
Yeah.
But what if the reason the old firm wants to stop the transfer isn't about an unresolved fee at all? What if it is pure, unadulterated office drama?
Oh, this happens all the time. And this is a fantastic transition into our final major operational topic, transfer interference restrictions. And this tests the absolute core philosophy of customer asset protection.
Okay, let's bring in our final character, Broker Bob. Broker Bob is a highly charismatic registered rep. And he decides to leave his job at Shady Securities to go work at the shiny new firm across town. Panicked, Pete absolutely loves Broker Bob. He trusts him implicitly. So Pete submits a written request to transfer his account to the new firm specifically so he can follow Broker Bob.
Mm.
But the old boss at Shady Securities is absolutely furious that Bob poached a massive client. The boss calls the operations department and says, "Block Pete's transfer. Bob stole him. I am not letting the assets leave. Can he do that?"
Absolutely not. Under no circumstances. This is a foundational principle of Fenimore rules. Customer ownership of the transfer decision is paramount. An employment dispute between firms, or between a firm and a departing representative, does not justify blocking a customer's transfer request.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture here,
yeah.
The firm cannot use a representative's employment dispute as a toll gate across the customer's exit. The customer is not property. Pete owns his assets. Pete gets to choose exactly which broker-dealer custodies those assets.
Exactly. A dispute about where Broker Bob works or whether Bob broke a protocol when he left does not magically convert panicked Pete's right to transfer his assets into a negotiable employment issue. The firm can sue Broker Bob for damages, but they cannot use Pete's account as leverage in that fight.
But let me play devil's advocate here, because I know the exam writers love to push scenarios to the extreme limit. What if Shady Securities is highly aggressive? What if they go to state court and they actually get a judge to issue a judicial order or a temporary restraining order saying Broker Bob breached his non-compete employment contract? Can the operations department block Pete's transfer then? Because a judge said so.
I am so glad you pushed back on that, because candidates miss this specific trap constantly. Intuition tells you that a judge's order trumps everything, right? But listen carefully. This is where the exam tries to get you. Even if the old firm gets a judicial order or decree that is sought to bar or restrict the transfer tied to an employment change, stopping the transfer is still considered prohibited interference.
Wait, really? Even if a judge literally signs a paper enforcing the employment contract?
Yes, because the employment contract is between Broker Bob and Shady Securities. Panicked Pete is not a party to that contract.
Oh, I see.
Right. The judicial order might restrict Bob from soliciting other clients, or it might force Bob to pay a massive penalty. But it does not extinguish Pete's fundamental property right to move his own money.
That is fascinating. The property rights of the customer completely supersede the employment drama of the broker. So, if office drama and non-compete lawsuits don't work, when can operations legally block an ACATS transfer?
The only permitted basis for interference is a strict account-based claim. Specifically, the carrying firm can halt the transfer if the account is subject to a lien for money owed by the customer or another bona fide claim directly against the account's assets.
Let's summarize that mechanism so it is crystal clear. If Panic Pete owes Shady Securities $50,000 in margin debt that is a lien against the account for money owed, they have a bona fide claim. They can stop the transfer until he deposits cash to cover the margin call. But if they are just mad at Broker Bob for leaving, they must process the transfer, period.
That is exactly right. Debt owed by the customer. The firm has a valid lien to block, employment dispute with the broker. The firm must process the transfer without delay.
So what does this all mean? We have covered a massive amount of operational ground today, from the digital plumbing of Fedwire, to the liability of medallion stamps, to the wily coyote float of check kiting, and finally to bitter broker rivalries. It is time for the rapid fire recap. Let's lock in the top testable takeaway so you can walk into function one and absolutely dominate. I'll start, you follow.
Let's do it.
Journals are internal ledger entries that never leave the broker dealer. Wire transfers and ACH are external payments that physically move funds between different institutions.
On a physical check, the drawer writes the command, the pay receives the funds, and the drawee is the paying bank holding the cash.
Check kiting is an accounting illusion. It uses the float timing differences between banks to create apparent funds, not actual funds.
For account transfers, automated ACATS instructions go directly to the receiving member. Manual, non-ACATS partial transfers require alternate instructions sent directly to the carrying member.
Carrying firms commit a severe rule violation if they delay transfers over a fee dispute. Upon validation, they must immediately freeze the account, cancel open orders, and transfer the assets exactly as they appear on the books.
If a dividend hits an old account after the ACATS transfer is closed, that is an ex-claiming residual credit. The automated facility handles it, and the firm must transfer it after it accrues.
And finally, employment disputes, even if they involve a judicial non-compete order against a broker, never ever justify blocking a customer's transfer. The only thing that justifies a block is a bona fide lien for money owed by the customer.
That covers the operational rules perfectly. But I want to leave everyone with a final provocative thought to mull over, looking toward the future of cashiering.
Okay, let's hear it.
We spent this entire deep dive talking about strict, highly regulated legacy rails. We have medallion stamps, controlled check blotters, and ACATS freezes. But as the industry moves further into decentralized finance and tokenized assets settling instantly on private blockchains, how are these legacy-controlled handoff points going to adapt? Will a system like ACATS eventually be replaced entirely by smart contracts that instantly verify ownership and port assets automatically without ever needing a carrying member's operations department to manually freeze an account or reconcile a blotter?
Oh, wow. That is a wild thought. The entire operational plumbing system we just mapped out could be completely rewritten by code in the next decade. Settlement times drop to zero and the floop disappears entirely.
Exactly. It changes everything.
But until that day comes, the Series 99 is testing you on the rules as they stand today. You are now fully armed and ready to conquer Function 1. Keep reviewing the mechanics we discussed. Keep visualizing Desperate Dan writing bad checks and Panic Pete trying to follow Broker Bob. And go crush that exam. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.